Side 5, The Divine Invasion, by Philip K. Dick. Continuing on page 158.
I don't know what you're talking about, Herb said, but if I could meet her...
You will, Manny said.
You're a strange kid, Herb Asher said. As they passed below a light fixture, he noticed something that startled him. He halted, and taking hold of Manny, he moved him directly under the light.
You look like Rivers, he thought.
For an instant, a flash of memory jarred him. His mind seemed to open up, as if vast spaces, open spaces, a universe of stars had flooded into it.
Herbert, the boy said, she is not real. Linda Fox, she is a phantasm of yours. But I can make her real. I confer being. It is I who makes the irreal into the real, and I can do it for you, with her.
What happened? Ribbis said when they reached the table. Manny has to leave, Herb said to Zena Pallas. The waitress said so. I guess you'll have to go. Sorry. Taking her purse and cigarettes, Zena rose.
I'm sorry. I guess I kept you from seeing the fox.
Let's go with them, Ribbis said, also rising. My head hurts, Herb. I'd like to get out of here. Resigned, he said, All right.
Cheated, he thought. That was what Manny had said. I will not see you cheated.
That is exactly what happened, he realized. I have been cheated this evening.
Well, some other time. It would be interesting to talk to her, maybe get her autograph.
He thought, close up I could see that her eyelashes are fake.
Christ, he thought, how depressing.
Maybe her breasts are fake, too. There are those pads they slip in. He felt disappointed and unhappy, and now he, too, wanted to leave.
This evening didn't work out, he thought, as he escorted Ribbis, Zena, and Manny from the club onto the dark Hollywood street. I expected so much.
And then he remembered what the boy had said, the strange things, and the nanosecond of jarred memory, scenes that appeared in his mind so briefly and yet so convincingly.
This is not an ordinary child, he realized. And his resemblance to my wife, I can see it now, as they stand together. He could be her son. Eerie.
He shivered, even though the air was warm.
Zena said, I fulfilled his wishes. I gave him what he dreamed of. All those months as he lay on his bunk, with his 3D posters of her, his tapes.
You gave him nothing, Emmanuel said. You robbed him, in fact. You took something away.
She is a media product, Zena said.
The two of them walked slowly along the nocturnal Hollywood sidewalk, back to her fly car.
That is no fault of mine. I can't be blamed if Linda Fox is not real.
Here in your realm, that distinction means nothing.
What can you give him? Zena said. Only illness, his wife's illness, and her death in your service. Is your gift better than mine?
Emmanuel said, I made him a promise, and I do not lie.
I shall fulfill that promise, he said to himself, in this realm or in my own realm. It doesn't matter, because in either case I will make Linda Fox real. That is the power I have, and it is not the power of enchantment. It is the most precious gift of all, reality.
What are you thinking? Zena said.
Better a live dog than a dead prince, Manny said.
Who said that?
It is simply common sense.
Zena said, What is your meaning?
I mean that your enchantment gave him nothing, and the real world...
The real world, Zena said, put him in cryonic suspension for 10 years. Isn't a beautiful dream better than a cruel reality? Would you rather suffer in actuality than enjoy yourself in the domain of...
She paused.
Intoxication, he said. That is what your domain consists of. It is a drunken world, drunken with dancing and with joy.
I say that the quality of realness is more important than any other quality, because once realness departs, there is nothing. A dream is nothing. I disagree with you. I say you cheated Herbert Asher. I say you did a cruel thing to him. I saw his reaction. I measured his dejection. And I will make it up to him. You will make the fox real. Is it your wager that I can't? My wager, Zena said, is that it doesn't matter. Real or not, she is worthless. You will have achieved nothing. I accept the wager, he said. Shake my hand on it. She extended her hand. They shook, standing there on the Hollywood sidewalk, under the glaring artificial light. As they flew back to Washington, D.C., Zena said, In my realm, many things are different. Perhaps you would like to meet party chairman Nicholas Bulkowski. Emmanuel said, Is he not the procurator? The Communist Party has not the world power that you are accustomed to. The term scientific legate is not known, nor is Fulton Statler Harms the chief prelate of the CIC, inasmuch as no Christian Islamic church exists. He is a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church. He does not control the lives of millions. That is good, Emmanuel said. Then I have done well in my domain, Zena said. Do you agree? Because if you agree... These are good things, Emmanuel said. Tell me your objection. It is an illusion. In the real world, both men hold world power. They jointly control the planet. Zena said, I will tell you something you do not understand. We have made changes in the past. We saw to it that the CIC and the SL did not come into existence. The world you see here, my world, is an alternate world to your own, and equally real. I don't believe you, Emmanuel said. There are many worlds. He said, I am the generator of world. I and I alone. No one else can create world. I am he who causes to be. You are not. Nonetheless, you do not understand, Emmanuel said. There are many potentialities that do not become actualized. I select from among the potentialities the ones I prefer, and I bestow actuality onto them. Then you have made poor choices. It would have been far better if the CIC and the SL never came into being. You admit, then, that your world is not real, that it is a forgery. Zena hesitated. It branched off at crucial points due to our interference with the past. Call it magic if you want, or call it technology. In any case, we can enter retro time and overrule mistakes in history. We have done that. In this alternate world, Bulkowski and Harms are minor figures. They exist, but not as they do in your world. It is a choice of worlds, equally real. And Belial, he said, Belial sits in a cage in a zoo, and throngs of people, vast hordes of them, gape at him. Correct. Lies, he said. It is wish fulfillment. You cannot build a world on wishes. The basis of reality is bleak because you cannot serve up obliging mock vistas. You must adhere to what is possible, the law of necessity. That is the underpinning of reality, necessity. Whatever is because it must be, because it can be no other way. It is not what it is because someone wishes it, but because it has to be, that and specifically that, down to the most meager detail. I know this because I do this. You have your job and I have mine, and I understand mine. I understand the law of necessity. Zena, after a moment, said, The woods of Arcady are dead, and over is their antique joy. Of old the world on dreaming fed, gray truth is now her painted toy, yet still she turns her restless head. That is the first poem by Yeats, she finished. I know that poem, Emmanuel said. It ends, But ah, she dreams not now. Dream thou, for fair are poppies on the brow. Dream, dream, for this is also sooth.
Sooth meaning truth, he explained. You don't have to explain, Zena said. And you disagree with the poem.
Grey truth is better than the dream, he said. That, too, is sooth. It is the final truth of all, that truth is better than any lie, however blissful. I distrust this world because it is too sweet. Your world is too nice to be real. Your world is a whim. When Herb Asher saw the fox, he saw deception, and that deception lies at the heart of your world. And that deception, he said to himself, is what I shall undo. I shall replace it, he said to himself, with the veridical, which you do not understand. The fox, as reality, will be more acceptable to Herb Asher than any dream of the fox. I know it. I stake everything on this proposition. Here I stand or fall.
That is correct, Zena said.
Any seeming reality that is obliging, Emmanuel said, is something to suspect. The hallmark of the fraudulent is that it becomes what you would like it to be. I see that here. You would like Nicholas Bulkowski not to be a vastly influential man. You would like Fulton Harms to be a minor figure, not part of history. Your world obliges you, and that gives it away for what it is. My world is stubborn. It will not yield. A recalcitrant and implacable world is a real world.
A world that murders those forced to live in it.
That is not the whole of it. My world is not that bad. There is much besides death and pain in it. On Earth, the real Earth, there is beauty and joy and... He broke off. He had been tricked. She had won again. Then Earth is not so bad, she said. It should not be scourged by fire. There is beauty and joy and love and good people, despite Belial's rule. I told you that, and you disputed it as we walked among the Japanese cherry trees. What do you say now, Lord of Hosts, God of Abraham? Have you not proved me right? He admitted, "You are clever, Zena." Her eyes sparkled and she smiled. Then hold back the great and terrible day that you speak of in Scripture, as I begged you to. For the first time he sensed defeat. Enticed into speaking foolishly, he realized. How clever she is. How shrewd. As it says in Scripture, Zena said, I am wisdom. I bestow shrewdness and show the way to knowledge and prudence. But, he said, you told me you are not holy wisdom, that you only pretended to be. It is up to you to discern who I am. You yourself must decipher my identity. I will not do it for you. And in the meantime, tricks.
Yes, Zena said, because it is through tricks that you will learn.
Staring at her, he said, you are tricking me so that I wake. As I woke Herb Asher.
Perhaps.
Are you my disinhibiting stimulus?
Staring fixedly at her, he said in a low, stern voice, I think I created you to bring back my memory, to restore me to myself.
To lead you back to your throne, Zena said.
Did I?
Zena, steering the fly car, said nothing.
Answer me, he said.
Perhaps, Zena said.
If I created you, I can...
You created all things, Zena said.
I do not understand you. I cannot follow you. You dance toward me and then away.
But as I do so, you awaken, Zena said.
Yes, he said. And I reason back from that, that you are the disinhibiting stimulus which I set up long ago. Knowing, as I did, that my brain would be damaged and I would forget. You are systematically giving me back my identity, Zena.
Then, I think I know who you are.
Turning her head, she said,
Who?
I will not say. And you can't read it in my mind, because I have suppressed it. I did so as soon as I thought it.
Because he realized it is too much for me. Even me. I can't believe it.
They drove on, toward the Atlantic and Washington, D.C. 14. Herb Asher felt himself engulfed by the profound impression that he had known the boy Manny Pallas at some other time, perhaps in another life. How many lives do we lead? He asked himself. Are we on tape? Is this some kind of a replay? To Ribis, he said, the kid looked like you.
Did he? I didn't notice.
Ribis, as usual, was attempting to make a dress from a pattern and screwing it up. Pieces of fabric lay everywhere in the living room, along with dirty dishes, overfilled ashtrays, and crumpled stained magazines. Herb decided to consult with his business partner, a middle-aged black named Elias Tate. Together, he and Tate had operated a retail audio sales store for several years. Tate, however, viewed their store, Electronic Audio, as a sideline. His central interest in life was his missionary work. Tate preached at a small, out-of-the-way church, engaging a mostly black audience. His message always consisted of, "Repent, the kingdom of God is at hand." It seemed to Herb Asher a strange preoccupation for a man so intelligent, but in the final analysis it was Tate's problem. They rarely discussed it. Seated in the listening room of the store, Herb said to his partner, "I met a striking and very peculiar little boy last night at a cocktail lounge in Hollywood." Involved in assembling a new laser-tracking phono component, Tate murmured, "What were you doing in Hollywood? Trying to get into pictures?"
"Listening to a new singer named Linda Fox."
"Never heard of her."
Herb said, "She's sexy as hell and very good. She..."
"You're married."
"I can dream," Herb said.
"Maybe you'd like to invite her to an autograph party at the store."
"We're the wrong kind of store.
It's an audio store. She sings. That's audio. Or isn't she audible?"
"As far as I know, she hasn't made any tapes or cut any records or been on TV. I happened to hear her last month when I was at the Anaheim Trade Center audio exhibit. I told you you should have come along."
"Sexuality is the malady of this world," Tate said. "This is a lustful and demented planet."
"And we're all going to hell."
Tate said, "I certainly hope so." "You know you're out of step. You really are. You have an ethical code that dates back to the Dark Ages." "Oh, long before that," Tate said. He placed a disc on the turntable and started up the component. On his scope, the pattern appeared to be adequate, but not perfect. Tate frowned. "I almost met her. I was so close. A matter of seconds. She's better looking up close than anyone else I ever saw. You should see her." "I know. I've got this intuition. But she's going to soar all the way to the top."
"Okay," Tate said reasonably. "That's fine with me. Write her a fan letter. Tell her."
"Elias," Herb said, "the boy I met last night, he looked like Ribis."
The black man glanced up at him.
"Really?"
If Ribis could collect her goddamn scattered wits for 1 second, she could have noticed. She just can't goddamn concentrate. She never looked at the boy. He could have been her son.
"Maybe there's something you don't know."
"Lay off," Herb said.
Elias said, "I'd like to see the boy."
"I felt I'd known him before, in some other life. For a second, it started to come back to me, and then..." He gestured. "I lost it. I couldn't pin it down. And there was more. As if I was remembering a whole other world. Another life entirely."
Elias ceased working.
"Describe it."
"You were older, and not black. You were a very old man in a robe. I wasn't on Earth. I glimpsed a frozen landscape, and it wasn't Terra."
"Elias, could I be from another planet, and some powerful agency laid down false memories in my mind over the real ones? And the boy, seeing the boy, caused the real memories to begin to return. And I had the idea that Ribbeth was very ill, in fact, about to die, and something about immigration officials with guns.
Immigration officers don't carry guns.
And a ship, a long trip at very high speed, urgency, and most of all, a presence, an uncanny presence, not human. Maybe it was an extraterrestrial, the race I'm really a part of, from my home planet.
Herb, Elias said, you are full of shit.
I know. But just for a second, I experienced all that. And listen to this. He gestured excitedly. An accident. Our ship crashing into another ship. My body remembered. It remembered the concussion, the trauma.
Go to a hypnotherapist, Elias said. Get him to put you under and remember. You're obviously a weird alien programmed to blow up the world. You probably have a bomb inside you.
Herb said, that's not funny.
Okay, you're from some wise, super-advanced, noble, spiritual race, and you were sent here to enlighten mankind, to save us.
Instantly, in Herb Asher's mind, memories flicked on and then flicked off again, almost at once.
What is it?
Elias asked, regarding him acutely. More memories. When you said that. After an interval of silence, Elias said, I wish you would read the Bible sometime.
It had something to do with the Bible, Herb said. My mission.
Maybe you're a messenger, Elias said. Maybe you have a message to deliver to the world. From God.
Stop kidding me.
Elias said, I'm not kidding. Not now. And apparently that was so. His dark face had turned grim.
What's wrong? Herb said.
Sometimes I think this planet is under a spell, Elias said. We are asleep or in a trance, and something causes us to see what it wants us to see and remember and think what it wants us to remember and think, which means we're whatever it wants us to be, which in turn means that we have no genuine existence. We're at the mercy of some kind of whim.
Strange, Herb Asher said.
His business partner said, yes, very strange. At the end of the workday, as Herb Asher and his partner were preparing to close up the store, a young woman wearing a suede leather jacket, jeans, moccasins, and a red silk scarf tied over her hair came in.
Hi, she said to Herb, her hand thrust into the pockets of her jacket. How are you?
Zena, he said, pleased. And a voice inside his head said, how did she find you? This is 3,000 miles away from Hollywood. Through an index of locations computer, probably. Still, he sensed something not right. But it did not pertain to his nature to turn down a visit by a pretty girl.
Do you have time for a cup of coffee? She asked.
Sure, he said. Shortly, they sat facing each other across a table in a nearby restaurant. Zena, stirring cream and sugar into her coffee, said,
I want to talk to you about Manny.
Why does he resemble my wife? He said.
Does he? I didn't notice. Manny feels very badly that he prevented you from meeting Linda Fox.
I'm not sure he did.
She was coming right at you.
She was walking our way, but that doesn't prove I would have met her.
He wants you to meet her. Herb, he feels terrible guilt. He couldn't sleep all night.
Puzzled, he said, what does he propose?
That you write her a fan letter, explaining the situation. He's convinced she'd answer.
It's not likely.
Zena said quietly, you'd be doing Manny a favor, even if she doesn't answer.
I'd just as soon meet you, he said. And his words were weighed out carefully, weighed out and measured.
Oh? She glanced up. What black eyes she had.
Both of you, he said. You and your little brother.
Manny has suffered brain damage. His mother was injured in a sky accident while she was pregnant with him. He spent several months in a synthowomb,
but they didn't get him in the syntha-womb in time. So, she tapped her fingers against the table, he is impaired. He's been attending a special school. Because of the neurological damage, he comes up with really nuts ideas. As an example, she hesitated. Well, what the hell? He says he's God. My partner should meet him then, Herb Asher said. Oh, no, she said, vigorously shaking her head. I don't want him to meet Elias. How did you know about Elias? He said. And again, the peculiar warning sensation drifted through him. I stopped at your apartment first and talked to Rivas. We spent several hours together. She mentioned the store and Elias. How else could I have found your store? It's not listed under your name. Elias is into religion, he said. That's what she told me. That's why I don't want Manny to meet him. They'd just jack each other up higher and higher into theological moonshine. He answered, I find Elias very level-headed. Yes, and in many ways Manny is level-headed. But you get two religious people together and they just sort of, you know, endless talk about Jesus and the world coming to an end, the Battle of Armageddon, the conflagration. She shivered. It gives me the creeps, hellfire and damnation. Elias is into that, all right, Herb said. It almost seemed to him that she knew. Probably Ribbis had told her. That was it. Herb, Zena said, will you do Manny the favor he wants? Will you write the fox? Her expression changed. The fox, he said. I wonder if that'll catch on. It's a natural. Continuing, Zena said, will you write Linda Fox and say you'd like to meet her? Ask her where she'll be appearing. They set up those club dates well in advance. Tell her you own an audio store. She's not well known. It isn't like some nationally famous star who gets bales of fan mail. Manny is sure she'll answer. Of course I will, he said. She smiled, and her dark eyes danced. No problem, he said. I'll go back to the store and type it there. We can mail it off together. From her mail pouch purse, Zena brought out an envelope. Manny wrote out the letter for you. This is what he wants you to say. Change it if you want, but don't change it too much. Manny worked real hard on it. Okay. He accepted the envelope from her. Rising, he said, let's go back to the shop. As he sat at his office typewriter transcribing Manny's letter to the fox, as Zena had called her, Zena paced about the closed-up shop, smoking vigorously. Is there something I don't know? He said. He sensed more to this. She seemed unusually tense. Manny and I have a bet going, Zena said. It has to do with... Well, basically, it has to do with whether Linda Fox will answer or not. The bet is a little more complicated, but that's the thrust of it. Does that bother you? No, he said. Which of you put down your money which way? She did not answer. Let it go, he said. He wondered why she had not responded, and why she was so tense about it. What do they think will come of this, he asked himself. Don't say anything to my wife, he said then, thinking some thoughts of his own. He had then an intense intuition that something rested on this, something important, with dimensions that he could not fathom. Am I being set up? He said. In what way? I don't know. He had finished typing. He pressed the key for print, and the machine, a smart typewriter, instantly printed out his letter and dropped it in the receiving bin. My signature goes on it, he said. Yes, it's from you. He signed the letter, typed out an envelope from the address on Manny's copy, and wondered abruptly how Zena and Manny had gotten hold of Linda Fox's home address. There it was, on the boy's carefully written holographic letter. Not the Golden Hind, but a residence, in Sherman Oaks. Odd, he thought. Wouldn't her address be unlisted? Maybe not. She wasn't well known, as had been repeatedly pointed out to him. I don't think she'll answer, he said.
Well, then some silver pennies will change hands.
Instantly, he said, Fairyland.
What? She said, startled.
A children's book, Silver Pennies, an old classic. In it there's the statement, you need a silver penny to get into Fairyland. He had owned the book as a child. She laughed, nervously, or so it seemed to him.
Zena, he said, I feel that something is wrong.
Nothing is wrong as far as I know.
She deftly took the envelope from him.
I'll mail it, she said.
Thank you, he said.
Will I see you again?
Of course you will.
Leaning toward him, she pursed her lips and kissed him on the mouth. He looked around him and saw bamboo. But color moved through it like St. Elmo's fire. The color, a shiny glistening red, seemed alive. It collected here and there, and where it gathered it formed words, or rather something like words, as if the world had become language.
What am I doing here? He wondered wildly. What happened? A minute ago I wasn't here.
The red glistening fire, like visible electricity, spelled out a message to him, distributed through the bamboo and children's swings and dry, stubby grass. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your might, and with all your soul.
Yes, he said.
He felt fright, but because the liquid tongues of fire were so beautiful, he felt awed more than afraid. Spellbound, he gazed about him. The fire moved. It came and it passed on. It flowed this way and that. Pools of it formed, and he knew he was seeing a living creature. Or rather, the blood of a living creature. The fire was living blood, but a magical blood, not physical blood, but blood transformed. Reaching down, trembling, he touched the blood and felt a shock pass through him, and he knew that the living blood had entered him. Immediately, words formed in his mind. Beware. Help me, he said feebly. Lifting his head, he saw into infinite space. He saw reaches so vast that he could not comprehend them. Space stretching out forever, and himself expanding with that space. Oh, my God, he said to himself. He shook violently. Blood and living words, and something intelligent close by, simulating the world, or the world simulating it. Something camouflaged, an entity that was aware of him. A beam of pink light blinded him. He felt dreadful pain in his head and clapped his hands to his eyes. I am blind, he realized. With the pain and the pink light came understanding, an acute knowledge. He knew that Zena was not a human woman, and he knew, further, that the boy Manny was not a human boy. This was not a real world he was in. He understood that because the beam of pink light had told him that. This world was a simulation, and something living and intelligent and sympathetic wanted him to know. Something cares about me, and it has penetrated this world to warn me, he realized. And it is camouflaged as this world, so that the master of this world, the lord of this unreal realm, will not know. Not know it is here, and not know it has told me. This is a terrible secret to know, he thought. I could be killed for knowing this. I am in a... Fear not.
Okay, he said, and still trembled. Words inside his head. Knowledge inside his head. But he remained blind, and the pain also remained. Who are you? He said. Tell me your name.
Valis.
Who is Valis? He said.
The Lord your God.
He said, don't hurt me.
Be not afraid, man.
His sight began to clear. He removed his hands from before his eyes. Zena stood there in her suede leather jacket and jeans,
Only a second had passed. She was moving back after having kissed him. Did she know? How could she know? Only he and Valis knew. He said, "You are a fairy."
"A what?"
She began to laugh. "That information was transferred to me. I know. I know everything. I remember CY30, CY30B. I remember my dome. I remember Ribbus's illness and the trip to Earth, the accident. I remember that whole other world, the real world. It penetrated into this world and woke me up." He stared at her, and in return, Xena stared fixedly back.
"My name means fairy," Xena said, "but that doesn't make me a fairy. Emmanuel means God with us, but that doesn't make him God."
Herb Asher said, "I remember Yah."
"Oh," she said. "Well, goodness."
"Emmanuel is Yah," Herb Asher said.
"I'm leaving," Xena said.
Hands in her jacket pockets, she walked rapidly to the front door of the store, turned the key in the lock, and disappeared outside. In an instant, she was gone. "She has the letter," he realized. "My letter to the fox." Hurriedly, he followed after her. No sign of her. He peered in all directions, cars and people, but not Xena. She had gotten away. "She will mail it," he said to himself. "The bet between her and Emmanuel. It involves me. They are wagering over me, and the universe itself is at stake. Impossible." But the beam of pink light had told him. It had conveyed all that, instantly, without the passage of any time at all. Trembling, his head still aching, he returned to the store. He seated himself and rubbed his aching forehead. "She will involve me with the fox," he realized. "And out of that involvement, depending on which way it goes, the structure of reality will..." He was not sure what it would do, but that was the issue, the structure of reality itself, the universe and every living creature in it. "It has to do with being," he thought to himself. Knowing this because, and only because, of the beam of pink light, which was a living electrical blood, the blood of some immense meta-entity. "Sein," he thought. "A German word. What does it mean?" "Das Nichts." The opposite of Sein. Sein equaled being, equaled existence, equaled a genuine universe. Das Nichts. Equally nothing, equaled the simulation of the universe, the dream, which I am in now, he knew. The pink beam told me that. "I need a drink," he said to himself. Picking up the phone, he dropped in the punch card and was immediately connected with his home. "Ribbus," he said huskily, "I'll be late." "You're taking her out? That girl?" His wife's voice was brittle. "No, goddammit," he said, and hung up the phone. God is the guarantor of the universe, he realized. That is the foundation of what I have been told. Without God, there is nothing. It all flows away and is gone. Locking up the store, he got into his fly car and turned on the motor. Standing on the sidewalk, a man. A familiar man. A black. Middle-aged. Well-dressed. "Elias," Herb called. "What are you doing? What is it?" "I came back to see if you were all right." Elias Tate walked up to Herb's car. "You're totally pale."
"Get in the car," Herb said.
Elias got in. 15. At the bar, both men sat as they often sat. Elias, as always, had a Coke with ice. He never drank. "Okay," he said, nodding. "There's nothing you can do to stop the letter. It's probably already mailed." "I'm a poker chip," Herb Asher said. between Zena and Emmanuel.
They're not betting as to whether Linda Fox will answer, Elias said. They're betting on something else. He wadded up a bit of cardboard and dropped it into his coat. There is no way in the world that you're going to be able to figure out what their wager is. The bamboo and the children's swings, the stubble growing. I have a residual memory of that myself. I dream about it. It's a school for kids, a special school. I go there in my sleep again and again.
The real world, Herb said.
Apparently. You've reconstructed a lot.
Don't go around saying God told you this is a fake universe, Herb. Don't tell anybody else what you've told me.
Do you believe me?
I believe you've had a very unusual and inexplicable experience, but I don't believe this is an ersatz world. It seems perfectly substantial.
He rapped on the plastic surface of the table between them.
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe in unreal worlds. There is only one cosmos, and Jehovah God created it.
I don't think anyone creates a fake universe, Herb said, since it isn't there.
But you're saying someone is causing us to see a universe that doesn't exist. Who is this someone?
He said, Satan.
Cocking his head, Elias eyed him.
It's a way of seeing the real world, Herb said, an occluded way, a dreamlike way, a hypnotized asleep way. The nature of world undergoes a perceptual change. Actually, it is the perceptions that change, not the world. The change is in us.
The ape of God, Elias said.
A medieval theory about the devil, that he apes God's legitimate creation with spurious interpolations of his own. That's really an exceedingly sophisticated idea, epistemologically speaking. Does it mean that parts of the world are spurious? Or that sometimes the whole world is spurious? Or that there are plural worlds of which one is real and the others are not? Is there essentially one matrix world from which people derive differing perceptions, so that the world you see is not the world I see?
I just know, Herb said, that I was caused to remember, made to remember the real world. My knowledge that this world here, he tapped the table, is based on that memory, not on my experience of this forgery. I am comparing. I have something to compare this world with. That is it.
Couldn't the memories be false?
I know they are not.
How do you know?
I trust the beam of pink light.
Why?
I don't know, he said.
Because it said it was God? The agency of enchantment can say that. The demonic power.
We'll see, Herb Asher said.
He wondered once more what the wager was, what they expected him to do.
5 days later, at his home, he received a long-distance person-to-person phone call. On the screen, a slightly chubby female face appeared, and a shy, breathless voice said,
Mr. Asher, this is Linda Fox. I'm calling you from California. I got your letter.
His heart ceased to beat. It stilled within him.
Hello, Linda, he said.
Miss Fox, I guess.
He felt numbed. I'll tell you why I'm calling.
She had a gentle voice, a rushing, excited voice. It was as if she panted timidly.
First, I want to thank you for your letter. I'm glad you like me. I mean, my singing. Do you like the Dowland? Is that a good idea?
He said, very good. I especially like Weep You No More, Sad Fountains. That's my favorite.
What I want to ask you, your letterhead. You're in the retail home audio system business. I'm moving to an apartment in Manhattan in a month, and I must get an audio system set up right away. We have tapes we made out here on the West Coast that my producer will be sending me. I have to be able to listen to them as they really sound, on a really good system.
Her long lashes fluttered apprehensively.
Could you fly to New York next week and give me an idea of
what sort of sound system you could install. I don't care how much it costs. I won't be paying for it. I signed with Superba Records, and they're going to pay for everything.
Sure, he said.
Or would it be better if I flew to Washington, D.C., she continued. Whichever is better. It has to be done quickly. They told me to stress that. This is so exciting for me. I just signed, and I have a new manager. I'm going to be making video discs later on, but we're starting with audio tapes now. Can you do it? I really don't know who to ask. There are a lot of retail electronics places out here on the West Coast, but I don't know anyone on the East Coast. I suppose I should be going to somebody in New York, but Washington, D.C. isn't very far, is it? I mean, you could get up there, couldn't you? Superba and my producer, he's with them, will cover all your expenses.
No problem, he said.
Okay. Well, here's my number in Sherman Oaks, and I'll give you my Manhattan number, both phone numbers. How did you know my Sherman Oaks address? The letter came directly to me. I'm not supposed to be listed.
A friend. Somebody in the industry. Connections, you know. I'm in the business.
You caught me at the Hind? The acoustics are peculiar there. Could you hear me all right? You look familiar. I think I saw you in the audience. You were standing in the corner.
I had a little boy with me.
Linda Fox said, I did see you. You were looking at me. You had the most unusual expression. Is he your son?
No, he said.
Are you ready to write down these numbers?
She gave him her two phone numbers. He wrote them down shakily. I'll put in a hell of an audio system for you, he managed to say. It's been a terrific treat talking to you. I'm convinced you're going all the way to the top of the charts. You're going to be listened to and looked at all over the galaxy. I know it. Believe me.
You are so sweet, Linda Fox said. I have to go now. Thank you, okay? Goodbye. I'll be expecting to hear from you. Don't forget, this is urgent. It has to be done. So many problems, but it's exciting. Goodbye.
She hung up. As he hung up the phone, Herb Asher said aloud, I'll be goddamned. I don't believe it. From behind him, Ribbis said, She called you. She actually phoned you. That's quite something. Are you going to put in a system for her? It means... I don't mind flying to New York. I'll acquire the components up there. No need to transport them from down here. Do you think you should take Elias with you? We'll see, he said, his mind clouded, buzzing with awe.
Congratulations, Ribbis said. I have a hunch I should go with you, but if you promise not to...
It's okay, he said, barely listening to her. The fox, he said.
I talked to her. She called me. Me. Didn't you tell me something about Xena and her little brother having some kind of bet? They bet, one of them bet, she wouldn't answer your letter, and the other bet she would.
Yeah, he said. There's a bet. He did not care about the bet. I will see her, he said to himself. I will visit her new Manhattan apartment, spend an evening with her. Clothes. I need new clothes. Christ, I have to look good.
How much gear do you think you can unload on her? Ribbis said.
Savagely, he said, It isn't a question of that. Shrinking back, Ribbis said, I'm sorry. I just meant, you know, how extensive a system. That's all I meant. She will be getting the best system money can buy, he said. Only the finest. What I would want for myself. Better than what I'd get for myself.
Maybe this will be good publicity for the store.
He glared at her.
What is it? Ribbis said.
The fox, he said simply.
It was the fox calling me on the phone. I can't believe it. Better call Xena and Emmanuel and tell them. I have their number.
He thought, no, this is my business, not theirs. To Xena, Emmanuel said,
The time is here. Now we will see which way it goes. He'll be flying to New York shortly. It won't be long. Do you already know what will happen? Xena asked.
What I want to know, Emmanuel said, is this.
Will you withdraw your world of empty dreams if he finds her?
He will find her worthless, Zena said. She is an empty fool, without wit, without wisdom. She has no sense, and he will walk away from her because you cannot make something like that into reality.
Emmanuel said, We will see.
Yes, we shall, Zena said. A non-entity awaits Herb Asher. She looks up to him.
There, precisely, Emmanuel declared in the recesses of his secret mind, you have made your mistake. Herb Asher does not thrive on his adoration of her. It is mutuality that is needed, and you have handed me that. When you debased her here in your domain, you accidentally imparted substance into her. And this, he thought, because you do not know what substance is. It lies beyond you, but not, he thought, beyond me. It is my domain.
I think, he said, you have already lost.
With delight, Zena said,
You do not know what I play for. You know neither me nor my goals.
That may be so, he reflected, but I know myself, and I know my goals. Wearing a fashionable suit, purchased at some considerable expense, Herb Asher boarded a luxury-class commercial rocket for New York City. Briefcase in hand, it contained specs on all the latest home audio systems finding their way onto the market. He sat gazing out the window as the 3-minute trip unrolled. The rocket began to descend almost at once. This is the most wonderful moment in my life, he declared inwardly as the retrojets fired. Look at me. I am right out of the pages of Style magazine. Thank God Ribbis didn't come along.
Ladies and gentlemen, the overhead speakers announced, we have now landed at Kennedy Spaceport. Please remain in your seats until the tone sounds. Then you may exit at the front end of the ship. Thank you for taking Delta Space Lines.
Enjoy your day, the robot steward said to Herb Asher as he jauntily exited from the ship. You too, Herb said, and plenty more besides. By yellow cab, he flew directly to the Essex House, where he had his reservation, the hell with the cost, for the next 2 days. Very soon, he unpacked, surveyed the grand appointments of his room, and then, after taking a Valzine, the best of the latest generations of cortical stimulants, picked up the phone and dialed Linda Fox's Manhattan number.
How exciting to know you're in town, she said when he identified himself. Can you come over now? I have some people here, but they're just leaving. This decision about my equipment, this is something I want to do slowly and carefully. What time is it now? I just got here from California.
It's 7 p.m. New York time, he said.
Have you had dinner?
No, he said. It was like a fantasy. He felt as if he was in a dream world, a kingdom of the divine. He felt like a child, he thought, reading my Silver Pennies book of poems. Apparently I found a silver penny and made my way there, where I have always yearned to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, he thought. And the hunter, he could not remember how the verse went. Well, in any case, it was appropriate. He was home at last. And there is no one here to tell me she looks like a pizza waitress, he informed himself. So I can forget that.
I've got some food here in my apartment. I'm into health foods. If you want some, I have actual orange juice, soybean curd, organic foods. I don't believe in slaughtering animals.
Fine, he said. Sure, anything, you name it. When he reached her apartment, in an outstandingly lovely building, he found her wearing a cap, a turtleneck sweater, and white duck shorts. Barefoot, she welcomed him into the living room. No furniture at all. She hadn't moved in yet. In the bedroom, a sleeping bag and an open suitcase. The rooms were large, and the picture window gave her a view of Central Park.
Hello, she said. I'm Linda.
She extended her hand.
It's nice to meet you, Mr. Asher.
Call me Herb, he said.
On the coast, the West Coast, everyone introduces people by their first names only. I'm trying to train myself away from that, but I can't. I was raised in Southern California, in Riverside.
She shut the door after him.
It's ghastly without any furniture, isn't it? My manager is picking it out. It'll be here the day after tomorrow. Well, he's not picking it out alone. I'm helping him. Let's see your brochures.
She had noticed his briefcase, and her eyes sparkled with anticipation.
She does look a little like a pizza waitress, he thought. But that's okay. Her complexion up close in the glare of the overhead lighting was not as clear as he had thought. In fact, he noticed she had a little acne.
We can sit on the floor, she said. She threw herself down, bare knees raised, her back against the wall.
Let's see. I'm relying on you entirely.
He began, I assume you want studio quality items, what we call professional components, not what the ordinary person has in his home.
What's that?
She pointed to a picture of huge speakers. They look like refrigerators.
That's an old design, he said, turning to the next page. Those work by means of a plasma, derived from helium. You have to keep buying tanks of helium. They look good, though, because the helium plasma glows. It's produced by extremely high voltage. Here, let me show you something more recent. Helium plasma transduction is obsolete, or soon will be.
Why do I have the feeling I'm imagining all this? He asked himself. Maybe because it's so wonderful. But still...
For a couple of hours, the two of them sat together, leaning against the wall, going through his literature. Her enthusiasm was enormous, but eventually she began to tire.
I am hungry, she said. I don't really have the right clothes with me to go to a restaurant. You have to dress up back here. It's not like Southern California, where you can wear anything. Where are you staying?
The Essex House.
Standing, stretching, Linda Fox said, Let's go back to your suite and order room service, okay?
Outstanding, he said, getting up.
After they had eaten dinner together in his room at the hotel, Linda Fox paced about, her arms folded.
You know something? She said. I keep having this recurring dream that I'm the most famous singer in the galaxy. It's exactly like what you said on the phone. My fantasy life in my subconscious, I guess. But I keep dreaming these production scenes where I'm recording tape after tape and giving concerts, and I have all this money. Do you believe in astrology?
I guess I do, he said.
And places I've never been to. I dream about that. And people I've never seen before. Important people. People big in the entertainment field. And we're always rushing around from place to place. Order some wine, would you? I don't know anything about French wine. You decide. But don't make it too dry.
He knew nothing about French wine either, but he got the wine list from the hotel's main restaurant and, with the help of the wine steward, ordered a bottle of expensive Burgundy.
This tastes great, Linda Fox said,
curled up on the couch, her bare legs tucked under her.
Tell me about yourself. How long have you been in retail audio components?
A number of years, he said.
How did you beat the draft?
That puzzled him. He had the idea that the draft had been abolished years ago.
It has? Linda said when he told her.
Puzzled, the trace of a frown on her face, she said,
That's funny. I was sure there was a draft, and a lot of men have migrated out to colony worlds to escape it. Have you ever been off Earth?
No, he said, but I'd like to try interplanetary travel just for the experience of it. Seating himself on the couch beside her, he casually put his arm behind her. She did not pull away. And to touch down on another planet, that must be some sensation.
I'm perfectly happy here.
She leaned her head back against his arm and shut her eyes.
Rub my back, she said. I'm stiff from leaning against the wall. It hurts here.
She touched a midpoint in her spine, leaning forward. He began to massage her neck.
That feels good, she murmured.
Lie down on the bed, he said, so I can get more pressure. I can't do it very well this way.
Okay.
Linda Fox hopped from the couch and padded barefoot across the room.
What a nice bedroom. I've never stayed at the Essex House. Are you married?
No, he said. No point telling her about Ribis.
I was once, but I got divorced. Isn't divorce awful?
She lay on the bed, prone, her arms stretched out. Bending over her, he kissed the back of her head.
Don't,
she said. Why not?
I can't.
Can't what? He said.
Make love. I'm having my period.
Period? Linda Fox has periods? He was incredulous. He drew back from her, sitting bolt upright.
I'm sorry, she said.
She seemed relaxed.
Start up around my shoulders, she said. It's stiff there. I'm sleepy. The wine, I guess. Such...
She yawned.
Good wine.
Yes, he said, still sitting away from her. All at once she burped. Her hand then flew to her mouth.
Pardon me, she said.
He flew back to Washington, D.C. the next morning. She had returned to her barren apartment that night, but the matter was moot anyhow because of her period. A couple of times she mentioned, he thought unnecessarily, that she always had severe cramps during her period, and had them now. On the return trip, he felt weary, but he had closed a deal for a rather large sum. Linda Fox had signed the papers ordering a top-of-the-line stereo system, and later he would return and supervise the installation of video recording and playback components. All in all, it had been a profitable trip. And yet, his ultimate move had fallen through because Linda Fox... It had been the wrong time. Her menstrual cycle, he thought. Linda Fox has periods and cramps, he asked himself. I don't believe it. But I guess it's true. Could it have been a pretext? No, it was not a pretext. It was real. When he arrived back home, his wife greeted him with a single question. Did you two fool around? No, he said. Worse luck.
You look tired, Ribbeth said.
Tired but happy. It had been a satisfying and rewarding experience. He and the fox had sat together talking for hours. An easy person to get to know, he thought. Relaxed, enthusiastic. A good person. Substantial. Not at all affected. I like her, he said to himself. It'll be good to see her again. And, he thought, I know she'll go far. It was odd how strong that intuition was inside him, his sense about the fox's future success. Well, the explanation was that Linda Fox was just plain good.
What kind of person is she? Ribbeth said. Nothing but talk about her career, probably.
She is tender and gentle and modest, he said, and totally informal. We talked about a lot of things.
Could I meet her sometime?
I don't see why not, he said. I'll be flying up there again. And she said something about flying down here and visiting the store. She goes all over the place. Her career is taking off at this point. She's beginning to get the big breaks she needs and deserves, and I'm glad for her, really glad. If she only hadn't been having her period. But I guess those are the facts of life, he said to himself. That's what makes up reality. Linda is the same as any other woman in that regard. It comes with the territory. I like her anyhow, he said to himself. Even if we didn't go to bed. The enjoyment of her company. That was enough. To Zena Palace, the boy said,
You have lost.
Yes, I have lost, she nodded. You made her real, and he still cares for her. The dream for him is no longer a dream. It is true, down to the level of disappointments, which is the stamp of authenticity.
Yes, she said, Congratulations.
Zena extended her hand to Emmanuel, and they shook.
And now, the boy said, you will tell me who you are.
16. Zena said,
Yes, I will tell you who I am, Emmanuel, but I will not let your world return. Mine is better. Herb Asher leads a much happier life. Ribbeth is alive. Linda Fox is real.
But you did not make her real, he said.
I did. Do you want back again the world you gave them? With the winter, its ice and snow over everything? It is I who birthed the prison. I brought in the springtime. I deposed the Procurator Maximus and the Chief Prevot. Let it stay as it is.
I will transmute your world into the real, he said. I have already begun. I manifested myself to Herb Asher when you kissed him. I penetrate your world in my true form. I am making it my world, step by step. What the people must do, however, is remember. They may live in your world, but they must know that a worse one existed, and they were forced to live in it. I restored Herb Asher's memories, and the others dream dreams.
That's fine with me.
Tell me now, he said, who you are.
Let us go, she said, hand in hand, like Beethoven and Goethe, two friends. Take us to Stanley Park in British Columbia, and we will observe the animals there, the wolves, the great white wolves. It is a beautiful park, and Lionsgate Bridge is beautiful. Vancouver, British Columbia, is the most beautiful city on earth.
That is true, he said. I had forgotten.
And after you view it, I want you to ask yourself if you would destroy it or change it in any way. I want you to inquire of yourself if you would, upon seeing such earthly beauty, bring into existence your great and terrible day, in which all the arrogant and evildoers shall be chaff set ablaze, leaving them neither root nor branch. Okay?
Okay, Emmanuel said. Zena said,
We are spirits of the air, who of human beings take care.
Are you? He said. Because he thought, if that is so, then you are an atmospheric spirit, which is to say, an angel.
Zena said, Come, all ye songsters of the sky, wake and assemble in this wood, but no ill-boding bird be nigh, none but the harmless and the good.
What are you saying? Emmanuel said.
Take us to Stanley Park first, Zena said. Because if you take us there, we shall actually be there. It will be no dream.
He did so. Together they walked across the verdant ground, among the vast trees. These stands, he knew, had never been logged. This was the primeval forest.
It is exceedingly beautiful, he said to her. It is the world, she said.
Tell me who you are.
Zena said, I am the Torah.
After a moment, Emmanuel said, Then I can do nothing regarding the universe without consulting you.
And you can do nothing regarding the universe that is contrary to what I say, Zena said, as you yourself decided in the beginning when you created me. You made me alive. I am a living being that thinks. I am the plan of the universe, its blueprint. That is the way you intended it, and that is the way it is.
Hence the slate you gave me, he said.
Look at me, Zena said.
He looked at her and saw a young woman wearing a crown and sitting on a throne.
Malkuth, he said, the lowest of the 10 Sephiroth. And you are the eternal infinite En Soph, Malkuth said, the first and highest of the Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. But you said that you are the Torah.
In the Zohar, Malkuth said, the Torah is depicted as a beautiful maiden living alone, secluded in a great castle. Her secret lover comes to the castle to see her, but all he can do is wait futilely outside, hoping for a glimpse of her. Finally, she appears at the window, and he is able to catch sight of her, but only for an instant. Later on, she lingers at the window, and he is able, therefore, to speak with her. Yet still she hides her face behind a veil, and her answers to his questions are evasive. Finally, after a long time, when her lover has become despairing that he will ever get to know her, she permits him to see her face at last.
Emmanuel said, Thus revealing to her lover all the secrets which she has up to now, throughout the long courtship, kept buried in her heart.
I know the Zohar. You are right.
So you know me now, En Soph, Malkuth said. Does it please you?
It does not, he said, because although what you say is true, there is one more veil to be removed from your face. There is one more step.
True, Malkuth, the lovely young woman seated on the throne, wearing a crown, said.
But you will have to find it.
I will, he said. I am so close now. Only a step, one single step away.
You have guessed, she said, but you must do better than that. Guessing is not enough. You must know.
How beautiful you are, Malkuth, he said. And of course you are here in the world and love the world. You are the Sephirah that represents the earth. You are the womb containing everything, all the other Sephiroth that constitute the tree itself. Those other forces, nine of them, are generated by you.
Even Kefer, Malkuth said calmly, who is highest.
You are Diana, the fairy queen, he said. You are Pallas Athena, the spirit of righteous war. You are the spring queen. You are Hagia Sophia, holy wisdom. You are the Torah, which is the formula and blueprint of the universe. You are Malkuth of the Kabbalah, the lowest of the ten Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. And you are my companion and friend, my guide.
But what are you actually, under all the disguises? I know what you are, and...
He put his hand on hers. I am beginning to remember.
The fall, when the Godhead was torn apart.
Yes, she said, nodding. You are remembering back to that now, to the beginning.
Give me time, he said. Just a little more time.
It is hard. It hurts. She said,
I will wait.
Seated on her throne, she waited. She had waited for thousands of years, and in her face he could see the patient and placid willingness to wait longer, as long as was necessary. Both of them had known from the beginning that this moment would come, when they would be back together. They were together now, again, as it had been originally. All he had to do was name her. To name is to know, he thought. To know and to summon. To call.
Shall I tell you your name? He said to her.
She smiled, the lovely dancing smile, but no mischief shone in her eyes. Instead, love glimmered at him, vast extents of love. Nicholas Bulkovsky, wearing his Red Army uniform, prepared to address a crowd of the party faithful at the main square of Bogota, Colombia, where recruiting efforts had of late been highly successful. If the party could swing Colombia into the anti-fascist camp, the disastrous loss of Cuba would be somewhat offset. However, a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church had recently put in an appearance, not a local person, but an American, dispatched by the Vatican to interfere with CP activities. Why must they meddle? Bulkovsky asked himself. Bulkovsky. He had discarded that name. Now he was known as General Gomez. To his Colombian advisor, he said, Give me the psychological profile on this Cardinal Harms.
Yes, Comrade General.
Ms. Reis passed him the file on the American troublemaker. Studying the file, Bulkovsky said, His head is up his ass. He's a spinner of theology. The Vatican picked the wrong person. We will tie Harms into knots, he said to himself, pleased.
Sir, Ms. Reis said, Cardinal Harms is said to have charisma. He attracts crowds wherever he goes.
He will attract a lead pipe to the head, Bulkovsky said, if he shows up in Colombia. As a distinguished guest of an afternoon TV talk show, the Roman Catholic Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms had lapsed into his usual sententious prose. The moderator, hoping to interrupt at some point, in order to achieve a much-needed commercial information dump, looked ill at ease. Their policies, Harms declared, inspire disorder, which they capitalize on. Social unrest is the cornerstone of atheistic communism. Let me give you an example. We'll be back in just a moment, the moderator said as the camera panned up on his bland features. But first, these messages. Cut to a spray can of Yard Guard. To the moderator, since for a moment they were off camera, Fulton Harms said, What's the real estate market like here in Detroit? I have some funds I want to invest, and office buildings I've discovered are about the soundest investments of all. You had better consult. The moderator received a visual signal from the show's producer. Immediately he composed his face into its normal look of sagacity and said in his informal but professional tone, We're talking today with Cardinal Fulton Harmer. Harms, Harms said. Harms, of the diocese of Archdiocese, Harms said, missed. Of Detroit, the moderator continued. Cardinal, isn't it a fact that in most Catholic countries, especially those in the Third World, no substantial middle class exists, but you tend to find a very wealthy elite and a poverty-stricken population with little or no education and little or no hope of bettering themselves? Is there some kind of correlation between the church and this deplorable situation? Well, Harms said at a loss. Let me put it to you this way, the moderator continued. He was perfectly relaxed, perfectly in control of the situation. Hasn't the church held back economic and social progress for centuries upon centuries? Isn't the church, in fact, a reactionary institution devoted to the betterment of a few and the exploitation of the many, trading on human credulity? Would that be a fair statement, Cardinal, sir? The church, Harms said feebly, looks after the spiritual welfare of man. It is responsible for his soul, but not his body. The communists enslave man's body and man's soul, Harms said. The church... I'm sorry, Cardinal Fulton Harms, the moderator broke in, but that's all the time we have. We've been talking with Freeze Man from Original Sin, Harms said. The moderator glanced at him. Man is born in sin, Harms said, totally unable to gather his train of thought together. Thank you, Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms, the moderator said. And now this. More commercials. Harms, within himself, groaned. Somehow, he ruminated as he rose from the luxurious chair in which they had seated him, somehow I feel as if I've known better days. He could not put his finger on it, but the feeling was there. And now I have to go to that little rat-ass country, Columbia, he reflected. Again. I've been there once, as briefly as possible, and now I have to fly back this afternoon. They have me on a string, and they just plain jerked me around this way and that, off to Columbia, back home to Detroit, over to Baltimore, then back to Columbia. I'm a cardinal, and I have to put up with this. I feel like stepping down. This is not the best of all possible worlds, he said to himself as he made his way to the elevator, and TV hosts of daytime talk shows abuse me. Liberame Domine, he declared to himself, and it was a mute appeal. Save me, God. Why doesn't he listen to me? Harms wondered as he stood waiting for the elevator. Maybe there is no God. Maybe the communists are right. If there is a God, he certainly doesn't do anything for me. Before I leave Detroit, he decided, I'll check with my investment broker about office buildings, if I have the time. Ribbis Rami Asher, plodding listlessly into the living room of their apartment, said, I'm back. She shut the front door and took off her coat. The doctor says it's an ulcer, a pyloric ulcer, it's called. I have to take phenobarb for it and drink Maalox. Does it still hurt? Herb Asher said. He had been going through his tape collection, searching for the Mahler Second Symphony. Could you pour me some milk? Rivers threw herself down on the couch. I'm exhausted. Her face, puffy and dark, seemed to him to be swollen. And don't play any loud music. I can't take any noise right now. Why aren't you at the shop? It's my day off. He found the tape of the Mahler Second. I'll put on the ear speakers, he said, so it won't bother you. Ribbis said, I want to tell you about my ulcer. I learned some interesting facts about ulcers. I stopped off at the library. Here. She held out a manila folder. I got a printout of a recent article. There's this theory that... I'm going to listen to the Mahler second, he said. Fine. Her tone was bitter and sardonic. You go ahead. There's nothing I can do about your ulcer, he said. You can listen to me. Herb Asher said, I'll bring you the milk. He walked into the kitchen and he thought, must it be like this? If I could hear the second, he thought, I'd feel okay. The only symphony scored for many pieces of rattan, he mused. A router, which looks like a small broom. They use it to play the bass drum. Too bad Mahler never saw a Morley wah-wah pedal, he thought, or he would have scored it into one of his longer works. Returning to the living room, he handed his wife her glass of milk. What have you been doing? She said. I notice you haven't picked up or cleaned up or anything. I've been on the phone to New York, he said. Linda Fox, Ribbis said. Yes, ordering her audio components. When are you going back to see her? I'll be supervising the installation. I want to check the system over when it's all set up. You really like her, Ribbis said. It's a good sale. No, I mean personally. You like her. She paused and then said, I think, Herb, I'm going to divorce you. He said, Are you serious? Very. Because of Linda Fox? Because I'm sick and tired of this place being a spy. I'm sick and tired of doing dishes for you and your friends. I'm especially sick and tired of Elias. He's always showing up unexpectedly. He never phones before he comes over. He acts like he lives here. Half the money we spend on food goes for him and his needs. He's like some kind of beggar. He looks like a beggar. And that nutty religious crap of his, that the world is coming to an end stuff. I can't take any more of it. She fell silent, and then, in pain, she grimaced. Your ulcer? He asked. My ulcer, yes. The ulcer I got worrying about. I'm going to the shop, he said. He made his way to the door. Goodbye. Goodbye, Herb Asher, Ribbis said. Leave me here and go stand around talking to pretty lady customers and listening to high-performance new audio components that'll knock your socks off for $500,000. He shut the door after him, and a moment later rose up into the sky in his fly car. Later in the day, when no customers wandered around the store checking out the new equipment, he seated himself in the listening room with his business partner. Elias, he said, I think Ribbis and I have come to the end. Elias said, What are you going to do instead? You're used to living with her. It's a basic part of you, taking care of her, satisfying her wants. Psychologically, Herb said, she is very sick. You knew that when you married her. She can't focus her attention. She's scattered. That's the technical term for it. That's what the tests showed. That's why she's so messy. She can't think, and she can't act, and she can't concentrate. The spirit of futile effort, he said to himself. What you need, Elias said, is a son. I saw how much affection you have for Manny, that woman's little brother. Why don't you... He broke off. It's none of my business. If I got mixed up with anybody else, Herb said, I know who it would be. But she'd never give me a tumble. That singer? Yes, he said. Try, Elias said. It's beyond my reach. Nobody knows what's beyond his reach. God decides what's beyond a person's reach. She's going to be galaxy famous, Elias said. But she isn't yet. If you're going to make a move toward her, do it now. The fox, Herb Asher said. That's how I think of her. A phrase popped into his mind. You are with the fox, and the fox is with you. Not Linda Fox singing, but Linda Fox speaking. He wondered where the notion came from, that she would be saying that. Again, vague memories, compounded of He did not know what. A more aggressive Linda Fox, more professional and dynamic, and yet remote, as if from millions of miles off, a signal from a star, in both senses of the word. From the distant stars, he thought, music and the sound of bells. Maybe, he said, I'll emigrate to a colony world. Ribis is too ill for that. I'll go alone, Herb said. Elias said, you'd be better off dating Linda Fox, if you can swing it. You'll be seeing her again. Don't give up yet. Make a try. The basis of life is trying. Okay, Herb Asher said. I will try. 17. Hand in hand, Emmanuel walked with Zena through the dark woods of Stanley Park. You are myself, he said. You are the Shekinah, the imminent presence who never left the world. He thought, the female side of God, known to the Jews and only to the Jews. When the primordial fall took place, the Godhead split into a transcendent part separated from the world. That was En Sof. But the other part, the female immanent part, remained with the fallen world, remained with Israel. End of Side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.